just started to learn about and get interested in the current political sphere in some countries now, with this worry over like a dwindling labor force, that suddenly the kind of solution is, right, more kids now.
Yes, and especially by particular families, right?
Like, yeah.
By local, by what we mean is like by white settler families in Canada typically, right? Or like, yeah, there's mm-hmm. a bit of conservative, a lot of racist sentiment that we see quite publicly in the United States government and also here in Canada.
Yeah, and it's linking so much with a topic that I've spoken about a lot on Intravenous and the radio recently, to do with autonomy, body autonomy, just every individual's right to have autonomy over themselves in the wake of the reproductive kind of injustices that was turning over in the US last year. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a prominent thing now of just, if we're talking solely of like women lacking agency and autonomy in this kind of contemporary society, that the pronatalist perspective is just very much feeds into that.
Yes, and like prizes for having kids. Like, we're going to see some stuff.
Yeah.
This happened in Canada during the interwar period in our history. So it's not, sorry, not the interwar period, during war times. So it's a return to that in a way, but it can masquerade as support for women. So that's really tricky. Like, I see cool analyses on social media about trad wives like this all the time, right? Mm. Like, what is that doing when the language of autonomy or choice is employed in defense of systems that have historically and continue to subjugate women? It's so complicated. It's so hard.
Yeah.
I think the lens of reproductive justice helps level the playing field. It's like the right to have children when you want to and not have them when you don't, and raise them in community sustainably. That also sort of cuts through the noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Kind of, I would say, following a similar kind of line of thought, I wondered if you knew much on like how does the kind of burden of unpaid care work contribute to the systemic inequalities that we see in society? So if we're looking specifically like at gender, both economic and like professional outcomes for women, through like this burden of unpaid care work, because it does have a big impact professionally, economically, if we're looking at gender inequality and working towards gender equity.
Yeah, absolutely. Put really simply, in my view, the undervaluation of unpaid work produces global inequality and reproduces global inequality. So it is that undervaluation of unpaid work in high-income countries like Northern Europe and the United States and Canada that have required the global care chain, right? Bringing women, migrant women from other countries to leave their families to patch the gap in care that is now low status work in a high income country as women leave the home for higher status waged work. So we can just think about the global care chain as one primary example of this like intersectional inequity caused by the undervaluation of unpaid work. But yeah, as you were mentioning too, like, we know how tight the relationship is between the undervaluation of work in the home and caregivers' ability to have political and financial autonomy out of the home. So if they, for example, can't find after-school care, and in their family, women are making less money, so they're going to pick up the kids, and then they're going to be stuck making less money. They won't have the same kind of career advancement or potential, right? Like, it's a snowball situation.
Yeah, and with this, like you were mentioning, the undervaluation of unpaid work, how, in like what you've seen, is it intersecting with other forms of inequality as well? Because we look, everything for me, when I've studied sociology, everything's intersectional. It's a big part of sociology being the intersectionality of it. So if we're looking at that, it's a very clear kind of theme into gender inequality, but how does that intersect with race, with class, with immigration status as well?
What I think about in the immediate is the temporary foreign workers program in Canada, right? Like, if we think about what are the big issues with labor, an underclass of laborers who have fewer rights. Right now, those are temporary foreign workers in Canada, right? Immigration status is tied to employer, and those conditions can be abusive and way underpaid, and those are intersectional, right? If migrant workers are mostly racialized, mostly not speaking English, lower income, and if we're talking also about people coming over as caregivers, then we can see how this disproportionately impacts racialized women. But it's also gendered masculine in Canada, as men do a lot of the temporary foreign work agriculturally. So but when we talk about gender, it's not just women. but we tend to forget that sometimes when we're talking about gender equality. So this is again like that undervaluation. I phrase it as like producing all kinds of inequalities. It's caused by, but also producing and reproducing status quo inequalities.
And as we're looking at this kind of intersectionality, what do you think are being the biggest cultural or societal barriers to actually acknowledging the unpaid care work as real valuable labor?
Oh, this is so challenging. You know what I think of? I think of people in my own sphere who, and my own work. So this is sort of anecdotal and based on research experience. Some people experience a critique of unpaid care work distribution as a personal attack. Mm-hmm. They experience it as an attack on what they care about, the partners in their lives who they respect, the mothers who did it, who they love. And so there's this author, Sophie Lewis, who writes a book called Abolish the Family. She argues that the family system we have created under capitalism is not sustainable. In fact, it's a form of violence. It's hard for people. And I think when people who are not experiencing an easy life, who are emotional as we all are, who are trying hard, for whom it hasn't been easy, it's hard to accept that something they are working so hard to protect and achieve is a form of violence. I think we have to have kind of empathy for that critique. And if we're pushing it, we have to have a lot of patience and think educationally as activists. Some people should be yelling it on the megaphone and not apologizing and painting it on their bodies and hitting the streets. And some people should be working with young children to teach them the importance of care and how good it feels to make breakfast for somebody. So it's multi-pronged. But yeah, I guess the barrier in my mind is fear. I think it's always fear, and it precipitates clinging to power and lots of forms of violence.
Mm. Yeah, I think fear is such a big tool that it kind of people don't realize how much like power fear holds in holding a lot of people back. Yeah, and I find it interesting, this topic, because this is a question I don't know if you'll have an answer for, because I was thinking about this in terms of, like, I don't have any children or anything, so thinking about, like, unpaid care work and thinking about what my mum gave up and did for me and my brother growing up, what would meaningful recognition of unpaid work look like for you, either in whatever way you want it to look, whether that's symbolically, economically, politically, whichever, all of them, if you want to, because I was thinking about this and I was like, I don't know if I have an answer to that yet, having not had kids myself.
Yeah. Oh, this is, you know, what comes to mind, this is not an answer to your question. Okay. I'm just going to mention this. What immediately comes to mind is Mother's Day, because we just had it, and how like fraught this day is for so many people, because on the one hand, we're trying to celebrate mother work, you know, as Black feminist scholars have called it, like the work that women disproportionately do. And on the other hand, we're pissed off, right? Like on the other hand, this feels like a slap in the face to have one day where it's acceptable to say thank you so much for being a martyr for our family.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you started with a personal example, you know, like having witnessed this in your house. How can we acknowledge this? So anecdotally, it goes a long way for labor to be recognized and valued. And just noticed. In the sociological literature, when people feel their contribution is valued, they are not likely to see it as unfair. So, like, we have a lot of talk around, like, how work should be shared 50-50. I don't know where this came from. I'd like to trace this one day, like, why we started calling something 50-50 that is, like, not a piece of pie, right? Like,
this yeah.
Is like, this is our entire entanglement of our entire lives. Like, how can we possibly cut something in half? Like, we're going to eat it. But I wonder, like, why... I wonder about the potential to just think qualitatively differently about the care that people are providing and say it out loud when we witness it. Like, certainly goes a long way for me. And in the literature, it goes a long way to recognize, to make people feel like they belong and that their contribution to this world matters.
Yeah, because when I was thinking about that question, I was kind of thinking, would people want something like tangible, like a material form of recognition? Or would it be something that is more symbolic that they would want, like Mother's Day is? But then Mother's Day also has its tangible aspect in that you usually will get a card or a gift or something for Mother's Day. So it's an interesting thing.
Such a good question. You know what, like, what I also find really important in terms of recognition, like, what gives me a sense of recognition that is not as tangible as a gift on Mother's Day? I mean, don't get me wrong, I love to be around all the mothers in my family being celebrated, and we have, like, nice coffee and nice pastries, and it is a wonderful celebration of gendered work in our extended family. But I also find it really emotional and makes me angry. But what something that gives me a sense of recognition indirectly is when I see my own kids or other people's kids in the community, especially boys, doing care work for each other or for the home. Like, I take such a sense of, like, relief, hope, pride, and really recognition that work is valued when I see young kids just naturally replicate it because they've been led by example and they've been showed that it matters.
Yeah, I think straight away to my older brother when it comes to that, because whilst I'm over here, I do get some photos sent of my mum, and it would be like, oh, look, he's made dinner for the family and stuff, because both my mum and dad would be at work and my brother would be at home and stuff. And it's just like the little things like that he would make dinner for everyone.
Nice.
And I think that's really nice, because it's like, he's a 23-year-old boy, and I think typically people would be like, he'd probably be sitting on his room in his room gaming or something.
Right. Yeah, that's incredible.
And it wouldn't think in his head to do that. Yeah.
So much effort, foresight. I love thinking about the kind of politics of noticing around the house. Like, who is the one who notices when something needs to be done and then does the heavy lifting of creating momentum around getting it done? Whether it's like the laundry at the bottom of the stairs needs to be taken up, or like that lampshade needs to be dusted, you know, who is conditioned to notice? And that's a beautiful example of a 24-year-old young man noticing that people have been working hard all day and need to be fed and taking initiative. It's such like a simple and totally beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And because we're running a little bit out of time, I wanted to sort of ask you a question that you, again, might not have an answer to, because it's looking at if you could implement one policy tomorrow to reduce this kind of gendered burden of unpaid work, what would it be and why? And you might, it's fully okay if you off the top of your head can't think of one, but
I think this is such an important question, because we have to do the visioning work, and I could talk a lot about it, but I will give you one short answer because of time. For me right now, where I am at in my personal family journey and considering the literature in Canada and beyond, it would be guaranteed after school care enrichment programming for kids focused on arts and culture, sports, swimming, and life skills. And it would be subsidized, and it would be available at every public school.
That sounds like such a cool idea. I feel like I had something not quite as, I would say, an enriching experience as that sounds. But when I was in like primary school, and I was probably like aged 8, we had like an after school club when it was like for the parents that couldn't get to the school pickup at like 3 p.m. or whatever the time was. But we would just be going into this separate building where there was staff, and we would just be given snacks, computer games, board games, and the TV.
I mean, that's not bad, because like you're at the end of the day, you're exhausted. It's better, yeah, than nothing or latchkey kid situations. But imagine that we actually had high standards for this time in kids' lives. Mm. And we knew that there were like, there's a crisis of not being able to get into swimming lessons in some cities in Canada. And there's a crisis of not being able to afford to take kids to matinees to enjoy arts and culture. Like, if we actually cared really deeply about raising the next generation to thrive, then I think we could I would love to wave a magic wand and create accessible enrichment programming that kids absolutely love, that parents don't have to feel guilty for using.
Yeah, I think that sounds amazing. As well as if you're getting it involved in outdoor activities.
Yes.
We're obviously heading into a generation of iPad kids and yes, constant technology. Yeah. It's like to have activities going outside and learning how to swim, because swimming is such, I find, such a basic life skill that my mum ensured me and my brother one thing that when we were young was that we knew how to swim. Because it's such a life skill that you may need.
That's right. And I'm telling you, and it was the same in my house. We had to do it to a certain level so that my parents didn't have to worry if we were on a dock somewhere or on a boat somewhere and fell in the water, right? Like, that was something we needed to have.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, there's a major shortage, and it is inaccessible in a lot of, at least, urban centers. But even rural centers, rural areas, I've looked into swim lessons, and they might not be offered every time of the year. So there are just lots of shortages and accessibility issues for that major life skill. And in BC, with it's a place full of lakes, we really need to take it seriously.
Yeah, in a place where there is a lot of bodies of water.
There's so much water here. That's what we do for recreation as British Columbians. So it's so important. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so,
absolutely.
Thank you. This is I love that question, actually.
Yeah. Well, you're very welcome. I'm very glad. I was thinking, I was like, oh, is this going to be a question where it's like an awkward silence and it's like, don't know what to say. So thank you so much. And thank you so much for taking the time again to speak to me today. This was an interesting topic because, like I said at the start, I don't know much about this. In my 5 years of studying sociology, this was not an area that was ever offered to me or I ever came across. So
that
I'm very grateful.
The discipline, but I'm glad we had this conversation. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
My name is Jamie Hill. I'm the Design and Communications Manager at Embark Sustainability. I think my favorite thing about Embark is that you do not have to be the climate know-it-all. You don't have to know everything about the issues that are going on. You really just need the passion to get started. So depending on what you're interested in, you might have a unique skill or interest that you don't think is applicable to climate at all, and it turns out you are the people that we need to be part of the community. So I'd really encourage anybody who has even an inkling of interest in climate or food justice to get on board. Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
Welcome back to CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, you're currently tuned in to Intravenous, where we have just heard my interview with the Assistant Professor Amanda Watson from the Sociology and Anthropology Department here at SFU, where we were discussing the issues around a lack of recognition of unpaid labor for gender equality in Canada, discussing kind of what recognitions we're seeing already, what we would like to be seeing, and how it's intersected in a number of different inequalities also. So yeah, it was a very interesting interview. I want to thank Amanda Watson again for taking the time out of her day to have that conversation with me. I thought it was very interesting and definitely put a lot of new thoughts into my head about looking at all the sacrifices that my mum made for me in growing up and all the work that she put in that maybe was not as recognized as to what my dad was doing as the breadwinner of the family. And I found some really interesting statistics and facts that I'd like to share surrounding this, in that since 1975, the International Women's Conference have acknowledged the importance and economic value of this work for communities. And in 2022, Statistics Canada actually estimated that the economic value of unpaid work was between $581.6 billion to $860.2 billion annually, which is a crazy number of unpaid work, and that this like invisible labor, it's so woven into daily life and so essential for societal function that you generally might just miss it and not even think about it, because it's like we were saying in the interview, it's so mundane, it's so ordinary and just part of your daily routine. And to genuinely address the inequality, as this is mostly done by women and girls, there is a need to broaden the understanding of productivity and wealth to include these contributions that are not reflected currently in traditional economic measures. And for unpaid work performed by women, it accounts for as much as 40% of GDP in some nations. Globally, we're seeing women and girls perform over twice as many hours of unpaid work each day as men. Also globally, women are making up around 80% of paid domestic workers, which means they are often engaging in caregiving professionally and getting an economic recognition of that, but then they continue to do it at home without the compensation of the same amount of work. And this increased time that is spent on unpaid labor will still be limiting women's potential earnings, that can potentially create long-term financial constraints, heightening a risk of poverty and things like that. And it's very interesting if you want to research into this further, since we do not have a lot of time left and I would love to have gone into this a bit more, looking at the gendered economy and the nuclear family ideology and how this is all linked in a capitalist kind of framework. It's a very interesting kind of perspective in looking at it, and how capitalism needs a stable, dedicated workforce, and the best way to ensure that it was that men could work long hours in factories, so you had to make sure someone was at home managing everything else for free, which is essentially the nuclear family model. So it's a very interesting way of looking at around the behind the scenes of that and how capitalism is interwoven into it as well. This actually, I think, will be a topic I will be delving into on my show Sociologic on Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m., because I definitely have not gone into it as much as I would love to on the radio. It's something that I've now kind of gone into a deep dive on. But unfortunately, we do not have enough time today. So definitely recommend people having a look out on themselves if you're interested in it, searching up the gendered economy, nuclear family ideology, unpaid work for women, and this like call to make it a forefront issue for gender equality and the fight for gender equality. So for the last 5 minutes, I have two songs I would like to play to finish up. The first one is going to be from a dear friend of mine called Michaela May. It is a song called Coasting off of her latest album or EP, Scared of Change. She's a new song coming out on June 1st, so I would strongly recommend everyone to go check it out. It's a very great song that I think everyone will be able to relate to. And then after that, I have the song Can't Pack a Memory by Ali Wick off of the album Sobbing at the Squat Rack. I hope you all have a lovely rest of your day and get to enjoy some of the sun. And I will catch you next week here on Intravenous.
Still frozen too. I didn't think today would come so soon. Guess that's what they meant by healing. Guess I found my cue to leave then. There's always more boxes than you thought there'd be. Funny, cause you can't pack a memory. I would put away for any day, but I hear it doesn't rain where I'm going. There's always more boxes. Doesn't rain. Here is.